And let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult life, I am proud of my country.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Welcome back, and joining us now is Mickey Folt. Mickey, if you want to get to Mickey, it's themercenarygeologist.com. And we bring Mickey on the show from time to time to talk about rare earth elements and other forms of things like that that you can trade. But today I wanted to talk about Mickey's first love, geology. Mickey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Alan. And you?
I'm doing well. It's always good talking to you. Now, Mickey and I both are going to be... What are we calling that symposium that we're going to be speaking at?
It's called the Liberty Mastermind Symposium, and it's in Las Vegas the third week of February. And it's a bunch of libertarians and hard asset guys, and they throw in a couple of anarcho-capitalists. This will be the second one of this series, and I look very much forward to speaking at it again.
Well, I do too. Mickey, as I told you last night when I called you to see if you had time to do this with me today, and Mickey's got to give is it a speech or you're teaching later on today?
I do a lot of mentoring to young geologists, so I'm going down to New Mexico Tech, about 60 miles south in Socorro, and I'm talking about the boom and bust cycles in resources and that how that affects employment opportunities for geologists.
What got you into geology, Mickey?
I went to school on scholarship as a petroleum engineer, and I got about two-thirds of the way through that, and I decided want to work on an offshore rig in the North Sea or sit behind my desk with a computer my whole career, and I wanted to work outside, and I've always liked rocks, so that was the obvious way to go.
I went to a military academy with a guy who wound up doing directional drilling in the oil business. Were you studying to do something similar?
Well, I went to oil school, University of Tulsa, as a bachelor's degree, but then I decided I wanted to be a metals geologist, so I came to graduate school in New Mexico, and that was it. And I've been an economic geologist concentrated in the mineral business ever since.
Well, what I wanted to discuss with Mickey after my very enjoyable conversation with our astronomy buddy yesterday, and we started off, Mickey, talking about that comet Ison, which is going to start appearing here in just a few days.
Mm-hmm.
But we covered all kinds of stuff, so I thought we'd bring things closer to home and talk about Earth. And when we were talking about the planet last night, I had mentioned Pangaea, and you said that Pangaea was actually the last supercontinent. What was the first supercontinent?
Well, there's no doubt that there was. Pangaea was formed about 400 million years ago and broke up about 250 million, and has now evolved into what, seven different continents. So we know about that one. Then we also know a lot about one called Rodinia, and that existed from about 1.5 to 700 million years. And then there's speculation among some geologists that there may be about five other ones going back to about 2.5 billion years in Earth history, but the evidence for those is somewhat equivocal.
But Pangaea is the main one that everybody pays attention to these days?
Well, yeah, Pangaea is the latest one, and that one broke up, and actually starting with Rodinia, we had modern-day similar plate tectonics and movement of continents.
Well, and for those of you who are not familiar with Pangaea, Mickey, would you mind just describing Pangaea and how you can take all the continents that we have now and bring them all together? You can see that they fit nicely like a jigsaw puzzle.
Well, they most certainly do. And if you remember from grade school geography, at least if you're my age, or our age, ages, I probably should say, Alan, you remember we would always look at a globe, and any grade school kid can look at Western Africa and say, well, that fits right into the shape of Eastern South America. So that was known for a long time. We just didn't have a mechanism to explain it. There was a German meteorologist named Wegener in early 1900s that proposed continental drift. He was laughed at and ridiculed by geologists, probably because he was a meteorologist. And he died in 1930. He was an Arctic explorer. So his theory never had real evidence. But by the end of World War II, Navy had mapped with sonar the ocean basins. And by the early 1960s, with magnetic studies, geologists realized that the Earth's crust is rafted on the mantle by this process called plate tectonics, where continents are formed and consumed. Oceanic crust is consumed at all times. It's like a giant conveyor belt.
Well, Mickey, we're all familiar with the continents, and, you know, we hear that most of the Earth's surface is, you know, covered in water. A friend of mine, a regular contributor, sent me, his daughter works up at MIT, and she studies quasars, but he's always getting this really good stuff. And even though the bulk of the surface is covered in water, the amount of water is really not that significant. It's just kind of shallow, even though we think of, you know, 200 feet deep, 500 feet deep. But relative to the mass underneath it, it's not a whole lot of water. So while we're seeing these continents move around, what's taking place under the ocean? The same thing?
Well, yeah, just like ocean currents, we have currents within the mantle, which is semi-solid, but under such great heat and pressure that it flows. So the mantle, there are currents in the mantle that raft the continents around, and they collide and they break apart. And we know this has been going on for at least 1.5 billion years of the Earth's 4.5 billion history, and likely much longer.
Mickey, what is the Ring of Fire?
Well, the Ring of Fire is actually one of these big plate boundaries, and it goes all the way from Tierra del Fuego at the very southwestern tip of South America, and it comes along the coast all the way up North America and comes across the Aleutian Islands and into Russia and down past Japan and through Indonesia and on to New Zealand. And this is a string of active volcanoes that represent where the Earth's oceanic crust is getting consumed, and as it is downrafted below the continents, volcanoes pop up. So the Ring of Fire is literally that. It's a zone of earthquakes and volcanoes that circumscribe the entire Pacific Ocean basin.
Are you familiar? Well, I know you are. I'm going to ask you that. Earthquake clusters, they do appear in clusters along the Ring of Fire.
That's very correct.
And is that because, like, pressure over here creates pressure over there? So if we see an earthquake on this portion of the Ring of Fire, then not too far away we'll see one over there?
Well, basically, earthquakes are fundamental flaws in the Earth's crust, along fault zones, and that's where the earthquakes occur. And every once in a while, those plate boundaries move catastrophically. Now, they don't move very far, but they move in catastrophic events, and that's what causes big earthquakes. And you will notice that the largest earthquakes in the world are always along that Ring of Fire.
Here on the continental United States, though, we have, and everybody's familiar with the San Andreas Fault down along the Pacific coast, but the San Madrid that goes underneath the Mississippi River? Isn't that another big one?
The Madrid Fault Zone, and that was the site of one of the largest earthquakes in the United States. It occurred, I'm not sure the date, sometime in the early 18th 1800s, 1815 plus or minus, and it completely changed the course of the Mississippi River. It is a bit of an anomaly, but there is a major fault zone there that will move at another time, and who knows when the next one will be. But, you know, the way they've straightened out the Mississippi River and channelized it, it could be very catastrophic if it happens. Well, it will happen at some point, and it's going to be extremely catastrophic.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, we have a fault line coming right underneath the city of Atlanta, I've always been told. And if you look at some of these earthquake maps that show the San Andreas and the San Madrid in deep, deep red, Atlanta, the Atlanta area is kind of a hot pink.
Well, and there's no doubt about that, because you're right at the edge of the Appalachian Mountains. And the Appalachian Mountains are ancient mountains that were formed by continental collision hundreds of millions of years ago, and they're old mountains, and that's why they're rounded and not very high. But those old suture zones still exist and can be activated at any time.
Well, I know from time to time there'll be a minor earthquake up in the Appalachians that sometimes can be felt down here in Atlanta, or at least the northern suburbs. In a quiet, relatively quiet area like Atlanta, can that one day become quite active just out of the blue?
Well, I think you would have a I'm not familiar with that particular fault zone. I don't know the magnitude of the earthquakes that occur there. I imagine they are relatively low in Richter scale, certainly I would think below 5, but before the Madrid earthquake and since in southeast Missouri, no one would have suspected, even in modern day, that a quake like that could happen. That was a really big one. So I would not, without really studying, I can't speak definitively, but I wouldn't rule out a significant earthquake in the northern Georgia area.
There was an earthquake that was out there in that San Madrid, if I'm not mistaken. I remember it had caused some destruction in downtown Louisville, Kentucky. And I was sitting up in my desk, and again, it's probably 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and so it was rather quiet, and I began to feel a very, very minor rumbling. And I remember thinking at first, you know, what's going on? And then I realized, damn, that must have been an earthquake. And later on, about 45 minutes later, lo and behold, there was an earthquake out in Missouri that I felt. I mean, it didn't do any damage to the house. It didn't do anything like that. But I actually felt that rumbling, and it was way below me. I remember it being way below me.
Well, and that's certainly true. I mean, when the world's second largest earthquake ever recorded was in 1964, just east of Anchorage, Alaska, and that earthquake was felt worldwide, and it even swamped boats in the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, the tsunami that resulted from that. So these things can be tremendous. They can be tremendously destructive. And we really don't know when they are going to happen. You can't predict them, but you certainly know that sometime within a period of time, based on recurrence of earthquakes and movements along faults, that they're bound to happen at some point.
Can we talk about the Yellowstone caldera for a moment?
Sure.
All right. What is a caldera?
Well, caldera is a giant volcanic vent that collapses and basically leaves a rim with a depressed zone in the middle. And so calderas are common very many places on the Earth, especially along the Ring of Fire, and inboard from that toward the continents. We will have ancient caldera complexes, but they're essentially big andesitic stratovolcanoes, and some of them are supervolcanoes. such as Yellowstone, that I think there's documented about 20 supervolcanoes in the world, and those are earth-shattering, earth-changing, climate-changing when they blow.
So Yellowstone basically is just a one giant volcano.
That's correct, and it is the ninth or tenth giant volcano that has occurred over several million years over a continental hot spot, and as the North American plate moves to the southwest in relation to the Pacific plate, that string of volcanoes migrates to the northeast. So there's a whole string of them, and this is just the latest one. And certainly it is the most active hot spring system on the world, more hot springs there than the rest of the world combined. I think the last time it actually blew catastrophically was about 640,000 years ago. Reconstruction shows that these volcanoes have a periodicity of about 600,000 years, so we're way overdue for a major eruption at Yellowstone.
How much warning would we get?
Pardon me, I missed that question.
How much warning do you think we would get that Yellowstone was about to blow?
Well, we will get plenty of warning, but I think it's impossible to predict the order of magnitude or how destructive it may be. There's a series of GPS instruments. There's a series of seismographs. So scientists can monitor that earthquake activity and movement of the earth as the magma chamber below Yellowstone fills and evacuates. And so we will know within some boundary of years or decades, we can probably predict when it will blow, but when that will happen exactly is way beyond what scientists can do now, and I would suspect what scientists can do in the future.
What likely is a Yellowstone eruption look like? I mean, let's...
Well, a catastrophic one like happened 640,000 years ago put out enough ash to cover the entire United States, something like a meter deep with ash. So it could be extremely catastrophic. I think the biggest problem would be that it would put so much ash in the air that it would drastically change the Earth's climate and could initiate another ice age. You know, we're only 10,000 years out of the latest ice age. We're still warming up from the latest ice age, and there's another ice age coming, and when that happens is also impossible to predict, but we're faced with lots of potentially catastrophic events in the Earth's evolvement, and no one knows exactly when they will happen. But you know, man's only been dominant on the planet for 10,000 years out of a lifespan of 4.5 billion years, to put it in perspective.
So when Yellowstone blows, and if its eruption is equivalent to the last time it blew, what you're saying is that it would generate enough ash from all the way out there to put roughly 33 inches of ash out in my front yard?
Well, not necessarily in your front yard. It's going to be the closer you are to the volcano, the thicker it's going to be. But the volume of ash total is certainly going to bury parts of the Rocky Mountain area, and it's going to be catastrophic. I mean, the climate change will essentially could wipe man off the planet.
Are there other Yellowstones that we need to worry about?
Well, Yellowstone's a bit unique in the fact it's the only known hot spot over a continent. But we also have hot spots in the Hawaii chain of volcanoes. The real danger there will be the Big Island caves up and creates a giant tsunami, which has done something in a whole, at least 60 giant tsunamis have occurred in the Hawaiian chain since it started forming. Probably the most dangerous place we have on Earth for in terms of earth-changing events would, in my opinion, would be Iceland. And Iceland is not only on a spreading center, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, but it's also on a hot spot. And historic eruptions, if we had another eruption to the size of ones we have documentation on in modern history in Iceland, could also create incredible climate change, just because you're blocking out the sun with the amount of ash that's in the air, and that can drastically change the climate and could initiate another ice age. I mean, think about what was it, 2 or 3 or 4 years ago when there was a minor eruption in Iceland and it grounded all planes for the better part of 3 weeks. You couldn't fly from North America to Northern Europe.
I remember that. I mean, time flies, but it seems like that happened within the last 5 years.
Certainly within the last 5 years. Can't remember exactly what year it was. Seems to me about 3 years ago.
You know, growing up, we've always heard the stories about California slipping into the ocean, but is that actually a scenario as California pushes into New Mexico where you are, isn't it?
Well, the number one, California is not going to fall off in the ocean, but at some point in geologic, in a few million years, present-day Los Angeles is going to be located where present-day San Francisco is now. So that is a transform fault, and it basically separates a spreading center, an oceanic ridge where oceanic crust is created to the south in the Sea of Cortez, separates that from an area where oceanic crust is consumed up in the Juan de Fuca area of the Northwest United States. So a transform fault is basically what it sounds like. It transforms movement, one type of movement to another type of movement. In this case, it's a strike slip fault, meaning it moves laterally more than it moves vertically.
Are we talking, though, like an inch a year, 2 inches a year? I mean, how drastic do these
plates? Yeah, I mean, in terms of average movement on the more active fault systems in the subduction zones of South America or Japan or the Aleutian Islands, commonly movement will be on the order of, let's say, something, and these would be the most active ones, on average, 2.5 to 3.5 centimeters a year, basically 1 inch to a little less than 1.5 inches. But those movements are not regular. They occur when faults move and when big earthquakes happen. So they tend to move in jumps, in fits and starts, if you will.
Well, as this pressure builds up, I mean, it's hard to believe that a few inches here or there could generate that kind of power. What actually takes place during an earthquake?
Well, big blocks of earth move relative to other blocks of earth. They basically, the deeper they are, the more fluid they are with the pressure and temperature. So, but at some point, there's a transition between what's called ductile deformation and brittle deformation. Ductile meaning that it kind of flows, versus brittle where it breaks. And so, when fault zones lock up like they do in, the Southern California area and the Salton Sea, say, up to, San Bernardino, California, the pressures build up till it fails catastrophically. And Southern California is overdue for a catastrophic earthquake on the southern end of the San Andreas Fault.
Mickey, last night when we were talking, you said that what's going on out at Yellowstone is bringing some of that gold to the surface. What were you talking
about? Well, yeah, the hot springs, it's well known by geologists that gold, one of the environments that gold deposits form in are the hot springs environments. You can go to specific hot springs in Yellowstone today, and you can sample the rocks and sample the waters, and they have elevated, very elevated levels of gold. There are gold deposits forming under Yellowstone today. If you look at the volcanoes, that string of extinct volcanoes back to the southeast, some of those have gold deposits on them. Steamboat Springs, Nevada, just outside of Carson City, is depositing gold today. There are gold deposits in New Zealand. Hot springs deposits are being mined and being formed today. One of the more famous ones is in the Lahir Islands in New Guinea, and that is a giant gold deposit that right on the sea, that parts of the deposit are basically too hot to mine because of the hot water.
The scientists are saying that the gold that we have here sprinkled down upon us as a result of collisions of neutron stars.
Yeah, well, that's the big part of the Big Bang theory, right? So that was when the element gold was generated, was presumably through these neutron stars. But what we're talking about is how you get those minute amounts of gold. The average content of gold in the Earth's crust worldwide is something on the order between 3 and 4 parts per billion. Mm. And to make an economic gold mine, you've got to upgrade that about 1,000 times. So how do you do that? How do you concentrate that gold? And that gold is concentrated by volcanic activity and hot water called hydrothermal gold deposits, and that hot water is the source of minute amounts of gold, which are then accumulated and deposited. So we have to have a mechanism to concentrate the gold that occurs in background levels in the Earth's crust, and that comes through volcanoes and hot springs activity, or that's one of the ways it occurs.
Well, in addition to gold, I mean, what other stuff on this planet has been sprinkled down upon us over the...
Well, let's go. I think most people are familiar with the black smokers on the ocean floor, with all the, and that's where life presumably originated on the planet sometime, but much older than 3.5 billion years ago. There's the Earth's been a water planet for well over 4 billion years. We know that there has to be water for life, and the early life was chemical synthesis through these hot spring systems on the Earth's floor, on fracture zones. So the black smokers, which exist today, and go back and look at some of the everybody's probably familiar with the tube worms and the crabs and all this exotic life that exists in the dark through chemical synthesis, not photosynthesis, but those black smokers are presently today making deposits of copper and zinc with minor amounts of gold in them. But we mine those sorts of deposits, ancient deposits, from periods of time two and a half billion years ago. Those sorts of deposits were forming back then, and those are mined today in several parts of the world.
One last question, because I know you got to get down the road. Well, where does the silver come from? If the gold comes from neutron stars, where does the silver come from?
I tell you the truth, I'd have to go look up Wikipedia and see the origin of silver in the universe, how it was formed in the universe. I can't tell you that. I can tell you that most gold deposits have a bit of silver in them, and there's hardly a silver deposit in the world that's standalone. Most silver is mined as a byproduct of either copper, lead, zinc, or gold, and or gold mining.
Hey, we've been speaking with Mickey Folt. Mickey is the mercenary geologist, and usually I have Mickey on, and we're talking about other things, but I wanted to talk geology today, and I guess you enjoy talking geology whenever you can.
Well, I certainly do. Most of my work now is on the financial end of the mining business. In fact, that's the reason I'm going to New Mexico Tech today to try to teach some young kids how to get a job and wear suits in an interview and take the metal out of your face and cover your tattoos and walk in with a one-page resume and a business card. But a lot of what I do is education and mentoring. If people are interested, I'll be in San Francisco November 25th and 26th at the Minerals and Metals Conference, and I'm giving a workshop there called Geology Explained, a key to successful speculation decisions. So it's an idea that if you know a little bit about geology, you can make better picks in the stock business and the natural resource sector.
Mickey Folt. Mickey is the mercenary geologist. Mickey, thanks for coming on. I look forward to doing this again. Maybe we'll get back to the regular topics. But now that we've talked about this, I want to keep doing it more often with you.
Well, Alan, it's my pleasure. I love talking geology. It's the love of my life. It's my career. Knock on wood, I'll never retire until I'm buried 6 feet under. But I look very much forward to talking to you again, Alan.
Thank you, Mickey.
Thank you.